Chapter 70. Super Thieves. On October the 16th, 1906, a humble shoemaker made a laughingstock of the Imperial German Army. His name was Wilhelm Voigt, and he had spent nearly half of his 57 years in prison. On that cool autumn morning, he was strolling along the streets of Tegel, now a suburb of Berlin, in the uniform of an army captain. Voigt had no right to the uniform. He had purchased it in a second-hand shop. A troop of soldiers came marching down the street, headed by a sergeant. Voigt stepped in front of them and roared, "Halt!" He inspected them, twisting his moustache. And then he told the sergeant that he had business in the town hall at Köpenick, 20 miles away, and he ordered the squad to follow him. No one dared question a German officer. They marched smartly behind him all the way to Köpenick. There, the captain presented each of the men with a mark and told them to fall out for lunch. After that, he lined them up in front of the town hall, ordered 3 men to guard all entrances, and told the others to accompany him. He marched into the mayor's office and told the mayor he was under arrest. He looked so fierce that nobody dared to say a word. And then the captain asked to see the cash box. An underling quickly fetched it. The captain counted the money, glared at the mayor as if to say, "Just as I thought," and then announced that he was confiscating it. "Take him away," he snapped, pointing to the mayor, and the soldiers fell in on either side of the bewildered official and escorted him out. Meanwhile, 3 soldiers were ordered to go and commandeer vehicles. The mayor and the soldiers were installed in 2 of these and told to proceed to the police station in Berlin, while the captain climbed into the 3rd. When the soldiers arrived at the police station, the 3rd carriage had vanished, and still no one suspected anything. The mayor was hurried inside, and it was some 2 hours before anyone realised that they had been hoaxed, and by then the captain had vanished with the cash, some 4,000 marks. News of the hoax travelled all over Germany, and then throughout the world. Even the Kaiser roared with laughter when he heard about it. "It could only happen in Germany," he said, with a certain satisfaction. But the police and the army were enraged. The bogus captain became Germany's public enemy number 1, and a massive manhunt was instituted. A few days later, Voigt was arrested in his room in a Berlin slum. He received 4 years hard labour, but was released after 20 months due to the behind-the-scenes intervention of the Kaiser. For the rest of his life, the shoemaker was something of a hero, frequently posing for photographs in a captain's uniform, and in Germany, the captain from Köpenick is still a very much admired figure. Voigt's haul was neither the biggest nor the smallest on record, but his robbery was one of the most typical in the annals of crime. For the real robber, the man with a vocation for it, has a touch of the adventurer and a touch of the comic opera hero about him. He robs for profit, but also for pleasure, for the excitement of the challenge. Indeed, this was the spirit displayed by the man who deserves credit for the biggest robbery on record. He stole a whole country. Pavel Mihailovich Bermont-Avalov displayed the spirit of the captain from Köpenick on a grand scale. He demonstrated his powers of bluff in 1917, when he was spying against the Bolsheviks for Germany. On his way through a forest, wearing a Russian officer's uniform, he came across a large ammunition depot. Without hesitation, he marched up to the Russian sentry, who raised his rifle and challenged him. "Idiot, put that down!" shouted Bermont. "Get out of my way, you ignorant peasant!" The soldier was convinced of the man's authenticity. Only a Russian officer could be that rude. Bermont marched into the camp, banged on the door of each billet in turn, and demanded to see the NCO in charge. Then, followed by a line of respectful corporals, he proceeded to make a tour of inspection. In a shed full of artillery shells, he walked out of sight, and he used a wrench to set off the timing fuse in the front of a shell. He then marched out towards the camp entrance. He was just passing the sentry when the explosions started, one setting off the other, until the whole camp was destroyed. Carried away by the spirit of sheer audacity, Bermont next led a small army of mercenaries into the town of Jelgava in Latvia, and rode down its red defenders in a magnificent and ruthless cavalry charge. It was this success which sparked in his mind the outline of a daring plan to take over the country. He called on von der Goltz, the commander of the remnants of the German army, and offered him 300 of his own men. Goltz said gloomily that it wasn't men he needed, he had 30,000, but money. "Leave that to me," said Bermont, and he hurried off to Berlin. There, as Goltz's representative, he visited various banks who held mortgages on Latvian territory and pointed out to them that if Latvia fell to the Reds, they would lose their investment. They quickly put 1,000,000 marks at his disposal, and Beaumont then prepared to double-cross Goltz. It was 1919, and in Vienna the Allies were discussing how to partition post-war Europe. Beaumont sent the British delegation a cable warning them that German bankers had sent Goltz 1,000,000 marks and that Goltz intended to take over Latvia. The idea was to alarm the French Premier, Georges Clemenceau, and the American President, Woodrow Wilson, into having Goltz removed. Next, Beaumont returned to Latvia, called on Goltz, and told him that he had managed to raise 250,000 marks. Goltz looked at him sourly. "Yeah, what about the other 3/4? He asked, waving a cable from the German bankers. Beaumont remained nonchalant. "They're sending that in a day or two," he shrugged. Goltz was suspicious, but he allowed Beaumont to go, and he sent an urgent cable of inquiry to the bankers in Berlin. Now it was a race between 2 telegrams, one from the bankers, telling Goltz that Beaumont was trying to swindle him, the other from Allied headquarters, stating that he was being relieved of his command. Unfortunately for Beaumont, the cable about the money arrived first. He was being tortured by Goltz's men when the second cable arrived, and Goltz realised that he was beaten. Beaumont offered him 250,000 marks in exchange for his army, which consisted of mercenaries, not German soldiers. Goltz, therefore, was not committing treason when he took the money and signed over his army to its new commander. Losing no time, Beaumont then marched his men onto the capital of Latvia, Riga, which was held by the Bolsheviks. Encouraged by promises of land and looting, the mercenaries fought spiritedly, and in October 1919 they took Riga. Beaumont was master of Latvia. He had stolen a country from under the nose of the Allies. All he needed now was time to entrench himself as the new king of Latvia. He was hoping that the Allies would see no reason to dislodge him. That was his major miscalculation. He thought that all politicians were crooks. It didn't strike him that Wilson and Clemenceau might object to the idea of Latvia being ruled by a superthief. The French navy shelled Riga. Allied troops poured into the city. With his army overpowered and helpless, the man who stole the country was forced to abandon his loot and to flee for his life. But, like the captain from Copernic, he moved for the rest of his days in a certain aura of celebrity. The exploits of Voigt and Beaumont Avalov draw attention to a point that's never been adequately recognised by criminal psychologists, that there are thieves and then there are super thieves. Robbery is the commonest of all crimes, and most thieves recognise that they are basically parasites with no real place in society. The super thief, however, does not accept anything of the sort. He belongs to the group of high-dominance males, and the high-dominance male is gripped with an instinctive craving for achievement, for adventure. In an obscure, perhaps only semi-conscious way, he feels that he deserves to be famous, to be a somebody. What he wants ideally is to lead a life in which he can commit robbery and, as sometimes follows, rape. The super thief is a loner. He has qualities that might carry him far as a soldier or a businessman, but he doesn't want to cooperate with society. The idea strikes him as boring. The concept of crime, however, produces a strange, almost sexual excitement in him. The Chicago University student and sex murderer William Hirons, for instance, began as a burglar, breaking into houses to steal women's underwear. He discovered that the act of climbing in through a window could alone induce an orgasm, and he offered this as a defence before being sentenced in 1946 to life imprisonment. Police in all countries are familiar with similar cases, in which burglars urinate or defecate in the flats they burgle. This is not, as it might first seem, a mere act of social defiance. The burglar gets his pleasure from taking down his trousers in a strange flat. It's a variation of indecent exposure. Some burglars slash beds and brassiers and panties with razor blades. There's a definite element of rape about these robberies, which is the distinctive stamp or calling card of the super thief, as opposed to the ordinary robber. The super thief, however, is not always a menace to his contemporaries. When a society is expanding and changing, there can be a place for him. For example, from the time of Queen Elizabeth I onward, the British government actually encouraged piracy. It was called privateering, because the ships were hired by private citizens instead of by the Royal Navy. But it amounted to the same thing. The privateers were entitled to attack ships belonging to enemies of their country, or anyone who gave those enemies supplies. This provided them with a fairly wide field. If for some reason they captured a ship belonging to a friendly nation, there was a simple way of preventing the mistake from getting known. to kill all aboard and to sink the vessel. The Elizabethan hero Sir Francis Drake was in fact little better than a pirate, using the war with Spain as an opportunity for robbery and plunder. Since the Spaniards were also in America and in the West Indies, this gave freebooters such as Drake a very wide range indeed. The West Indies became a nest of pirates, harbouring such characters as Blackbeard, whose real name was Teach, Henry Morgan, Major Stede Bonnet, and Captain England. Piracy was the ideal way of life for the super thief. He could rob, cut throats, burn towns, and carry off women. He could live out all his childish fantasies of aggression and violence. Many of them did just that, with horrifying sadism. This was why pirates seldom received mercy from the authorities when they were caught. The captain and the entire crew, right down to the cabin boy, would swing on the same gallows. Society regarded them as amongst the most evil kind of vermin. One of the most powerful expressions of the psychology of the super thief occurs in the famous drama The Robbers by the 18th century German poet Schiller. The hero of the play, Karl Moor, becomes the leader of a robber band because he says, "Only freedom breeds true greatness," by which he means freedom to commit robbery, arson and rape. The Robbers was admittedly one of Schiller's earliest and least mature works, but it establishes an important point, that even a man as gentle and intelligent as Schiller could believe that in order to be truly free, a man ought to be allowed to burn down nunneries and to rape the nuns. Most men can feel a sneaking sympathy with that point of view. It arouses an awareness that the super thief, like all high dominance criminals, is basically a man who never grows up. Children can never understand why they can't have the moon or why they shouldn't be allowed to walk into a toy shop and help themselves. As they get older, they become more realistic. Their desires mature, and so do their methods of achieving these desires. Some men, though, can never throw off the childish Peter Pan-like feeling that they ought to be allowed to grab whatever they want. If they also happen to be men of high dominance, then there is a good chance that they will turn into super thieves. Statistically speaking, society is bound to contain a certain number of super thieves. Some of them will be intelligent enough to become successful businessmen. For example, Gustav Meyer's book, The History of the Great American Fortunes, makes it clear that many of the most successful American businessmen were little better than pirates. The remainder will become enemies of society. Outsiders who, unable to make money legitimately, will turn to theft as naturally as tycoons and executives negotiate contracts, engineer deals, and originate takeover bids. Another salient fact about super thieves is that they seldom commit murder. Why? Because they have a strong desire to be somebody in society, and they realise that murder closes the door on social acceptance. The captain from Copernic spent the rest of his life strutting around in a captain's uniform. Beaumont Avalov wrote a book about his exploits and became quite a social figure. And when the super thief kills, it's usually because he's cornered and can see no other way of escape. In that sense, England's most celebrated super thief, the Devil Man Charlie Peace, is an exception to the rule. He was called the Devil Man because of his ugly, monkey-like face and his great jutting jaw. He also spoke as though his tongue was too big for his mouth. But these features seem to have been no impediment to an active love life. In 1875, when Peace was 43, he was living in the Sheffield suburb of Darnall, working as a frame maker and spending his nights in his favourite occupation, burglary. Two doors away lived a pretty, well-built Irish woman called Catherine Dyson, whose husband was a railway engineer. She became Peace's mistress, but she eventually tired of him and refused to see him. Peace flew into a frenzy at this and made such a nuisance of himself that the Dysons took out a court order to stop him molesting them. A few months later, the Dysons moved to another part of Sheffield, but Peace traced them so promptly that he called on them as they were unpacking. By this time, he had already committed his first murder. In August 1876, escaping from the scene of a burglary near Manchester, he was stopped by PC Nicholas Cock. Peace shot the officer, but two brothers, John and William Habron, were arrested for the crime, and William was later sentenced to death, although this was subsequently commuted to penal servitude. Peace attended the trial, and immediately after hearing the sentence, he called on the Dysons, quarrelled with Arthur Dyson, and shot him dead. Then he climbed over a garden wall and vanished for the next 2 years. In that time, he moved to Peckham in South London, rented a suburban villa, and became, to all appearances, a respectable Victorian householder, attending church on Sundays and giving musical evenings at which he recited pathetic ballads and played the fiddle. During this period, the police of South London were troubled by a series of daring burglaries. On October the 10th, 1878, two policemen saw a man acting suspiciously in a back garden in Blackheath. When they challenged him, he produced a gun and fired two shots, deliberately wide, shouting at them to keep away. One policeman was hit in the arm, but the other battered Peace to the ground. It was the end of the career of the Devil Man. To his credit, he confessed to the murder of P.C. Cock, and William Habron was released. Peace was hanged for the murder of Arthur Dyson on February the 25th, 1879. For some reason, he touched the imagination of the English. There are more legends about him than any other super thief since Robin Hood. That is not true of a man who perhaps deserves the title of the greatest super thief of the 20th century, although he is the subject of a crime classic, The Count of Gramercy Park, by Robert Alcorn. Born in Brooklyn in about 1890, Gerald Chapman had the typical super thief's romanticism, the desire to shine in the world. But his career of crime was at first unsuccessful. By the age of 30, he had spent nearly 12 years in jail on charges of burglary, grand larceny and armed robbery. It was during a seven-year stretch at Auburn in New York that he began to plan a grand coup which would make him rich. He may have been inspired by an acquaintance he made in the jail, the college-educated Dutch Anderson, who became his faithful accomplice. In Auburn, Chapman read books, learned about music and taught himself to speak with an upper-class English accent. When he was released in 1919, he gravitated to the Wall Street district of New York, since this was where the big money lay. On October the 24th, 1921, Chapman slipped into the seat of a mail truck, held up the driver, and forced him to drive down a side street. There were two more accomplices. Anderson and a man called Charlie Lerber joined them. They transferred the mail bags, containing more than $2.5 million in cash and bonds, into their car and drove off. The Leonard Street robbery was the biggest ever committed up to that time. Then, with thousands of dollars at his disposal, Chapman put into operation the second half of his plan. He rented a large house in fashionable Gramercy Park in New York. He called himself G. Vincent Colwell, and he and his wife and accomplice, Betty, posed as a rich English couple. Their evening parties with music were a great success. It was after one of these parties that a rich lady named Van Geddon discovered that she had lost a rope of priceless pearls. But she had no suspicion of Colwell, who presented her with a sapphire brooch by way of commiseration. Sometime after that, the police caught up with him for the Leonard Street job. He was traced through a traveller's check, and he was sent to Atlanta Penitentiary. From there, he made a daring escape with a rope and a grappling hook. He was caught 24 hours later, and he was shot in the back. In the prison infirmary, he managed to look so sick and feeble that the police allowed a visit from his wife. With the revolver she slipped him, he made another escape. But crime was too alluring. In October of 1924, he was cornered by two policemen while robbing a safe in New Britain, Connecticut, and killed one of the officers in escaping. Captured 3 months later, he was sentenced to death. His accomplice, Dutch Anderson, murdered an innocent farming couple who had given Chapman up, and was himself shot to death by a policeman soon after.